Hey everyone, today's book is about grief and how we grieve. And for once I decided not to include a joke in the opening. I decided it just now when Kellen heard my joke and said it was insensitive. The book is The Year of Magical Thinking by Joan Didion.
And this is The Book Pile, a podcast about the best of books and the worst of books. If this is your first time on the podcast, welcome. Also, may we suggest checking out our back catalog of over 150 episodes. We've covered everything from The Hobbit to The Roast of Twilight to The Big Short to The Roast of New Moon to A Christmas Carol to The Roast of Eclipse. Something for everyone. I'm Kellen Erskine. I'm a comic, a father, and someone who recently read this book right after reading the novelization of The Force Awakens. So probably the greatest tonal shift between books since I read The Grapes of Wrath and Goodnight Moon back to back.
And I'm David Vance.
All right, as usual, feel free to leave us an amazing review, and we might read it here. One of our most recent five-star reviews is from Sam Potter, who says, first of all, I can already tell he's trying to win Dave over with his last name. He or she says, love Kellen's stand-up and Dave's writing. Witty and intelligent. They're still just talking about me. I would love to see the guys review other genres such as popular adult fiction. Their choices seem predominantly YA fantasy / nonfiction. I'd love to see what their opinions on literary classics are, such as Catcher in the Rye, Tropic of Cancer. A takedown of a pretentious yet esteemed novel would be hilarious. I look forward to more episodes. All right, couple things here. First of all, I do love the idea of roasting a classic. Dave already did it with Grapes of Wrath.
Yeah, you weren't on board then.
Let's see one that we both agree on. So that's fine. But I also don't want to gloss over the fact that they say that we predominantly cover YA fantasy. I mean, sure, we've roasted Twilight and we've covered like The Hunger Games. But I also recall that we've discussed books by other people like Shakespeare, Crichton, Steinbeck, Oscar Wilde, Jhumpa Lahiri, John le Carré, Mary Shelley, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Sun Tzu, Virginia Woolf, Stephen King, Machiavelli. Although, admittedly, he was really into indoctrinating youth, so maybe The Prince does count as YA.
Maybe this reviewer just has a really high opinion of the youths.
He's just flipping through them like, ugh, Twilight, Hunger Games, The Shining. When will these guys finally get into some adult themes?
It's funny, too, that the ones they want us to read, like Catcher in the Rye and Mark Twain, are all books that the youths are made to read. So how much are we really getting out of YA?
When are they going to cover all nine of the books that they forced me to read in high school?
This was just written by an English teacher. What do you bet? What do you bet this was written by an English teacher who wants us to make jokes about books so they can then use those jokes in class?
But anyway, genuinely, thanks for the review.
Thank you.
They said they love my stand-up, so I can't really argue with any hair splitting after that.
This is how anyone could convince you of anything.
Yes.
So, Kellen, you're my favorite stand-up comic. I really need some money.
All right, if you want to see me live, I'm going to be in Des Moines, Iowa in a couple of weeks, finally, December 8th through the 9th. Go to kellenerskine.com for tickets.
All right, I have a Black Friday announcement for anyone who's doing Christmas shopping or just people cursed with a December birthday. A lot of you may know that for the past couple of years, I've been working on a project. It's a graphic novel escape room in a box. What you probably don't know is that this is how I found out Kellen's kids are smarter than me. So the way the game works, you follow a story in a graphic novel and a video about a hilarious child fighting dragons and escaping aliens. And then when the characters hit obstacles, you solve escape room puzzles for the story to continue. And when Kellen's kids played it, not only did they correct one of my Neanderthal facts, but they also taught me what a grill cipher is, which apparently is an espionage term. So the link is in the episode description. It's $39.99 on Amazon. And yeah, I hope you love it. So Kellen, this book wrecked me both times I read it. It's just so tragic and it's beautiful. For those who haven't read it, it's about Joan Didion losing her husband and how she experienced the grief in his absence. And I see all of these parallels with how I've experienced grief in the past. And Kellen, I should also tell you, partway through my prep for this episode, I just fully stopped trying to make it funny. So I haven't seen Nanette by Hannah Gadsby, but I Nanetted you. But what did you think of the book?
So yeah, for me, I went into this book with no idea what it was about. So I was secretly hoping it would be like a Harry Potter sequel. Just from the title. And boy, was I off. Although, the author probably wishes that she had a Horcrux. No, so this was my first... You weren't kidding about leaving me stranded with all the death jokes. It's how we cope with it. That's what I always like to say when I cross a line.
Yeah, it's a mechanism. Stephen Colbert, the other late night hosts were asking him if he had like a pivotal comedy moment, like when he knew he wanted to do comedy. And his was after his dad and two brothers had died in a plane crash.
Oh my word.
Either on the way to or from the funeral, one of his sisters made the other sister laugh so hard that she fell on the ground. And he was thinking, if laughter can do this even here in like the worst time, then I want to do this.
Wow, that's powerful.
Yeah.
So this is my first book by Joan Didion. I mean, her novel, Play It Where It Lays, has perpetually been on my book list titled Novels That I'm Supposed to Have Read By Now, which is an actual list that I have, and I'll be reading
that. Oh, do you really?
Yeah. I'll be reading that on our Patreon bonus episode this week. In all earnestness, though, this book, I haven't lost anyone with the severity that Joan Didion has. Mm-hmm. But for those who have, I imagine that this is a wonderful book, a support, like a glimmer of relief from that principle that sometimes a shared hurt can make it hurt just a little bit less.
Yeah.
But this book still became very important for me in being able to understand better what people go through. We spend so much time in her head after these incidents, and it was enlightening and in a heavy way, experiencing the emotions and shifts of thought processes that I was completely unfamiliar with. Like, one of my biggest takeaways from the book was how much more of an incredibly complex emotional experience loss is than just sad. All right, and without further ado, here are two lessons that we took from The Year of Magical Thinking. All right, lesson one, honesty induces greater empathy. So another title I came up with this was, honesty is like bait for catching big empathy fish. I figured I did need to treat our listeners like idiots by over-explaining it with an intelligent metaphor. So as I mentioned earlier, this book was really good for me as it presented one person's experience with loss. And not just anyone, but a writer renowned for being honest, articulate, and brave. Like, just imagine if I wrote a book, but I was also articulate and brave.
Aren't you working on a book?
I am, yeah. But I'm also not punctual. And I don't want to oversimplify it by just calling it honesty. Like, there are plenty of memoirs out there where I'm sure the people writing them felt like they were being honest in their expression. But she does it in a way where she also doesn't filter out the negative thoughts.
Yeah.
So, for example, and just to compare and contrast, and not to minimize anyone, I just arbitrarily chose Matthew McConaughey here. When he writes about losing his father, I'm sure that he mourned, but of that loss, in his memoir, Green Lights, McConaughey writes, "Time to say goodbye to the boy I'd been, building tree houses in the middle of the night. Now the world was flat and I was looking it in the eye. It was time to sober up from boyhood whimsy. It was time for me to become a man."
By the way, dad is dead.
Right. It immediately becomes about him.
Don't you think if someone gave that eulogy, you'd be like, oh, so he was a terrible father?
And then after this, he has this really long poem where he repeats the phrase, man enough, as in like, I can be man enough. And he says enough probably 100 times. You have to read it. But every time he says it, he spells the word enough ENUF.
Oh, no.
And I don't know why. Maybe it's because those are four the letters that you need for spelling funeral. I don't know. I'm not here to make fun of how someone expresses themselves. I'm just, again...
Except Matthew.
Just... Well, it was a little odd.
Right? It's one of the weirdest memoirs I've ever read.
Yeah.
The Year of Magical Thinking is about a year of grief so powerful that all of her thoughts detach from reality. Green Lights by Matthew McConaughey is about a man so handsome and talented that for his whole life, his thoughts can be detached from reality and he'll still succeed.
In this one part where she's speaking of the difference between mourning and grieving, she writes, "Grief is different. Grief has no distance. Grief comes in waves, paroxysms, sudden apprehensions that weaken the knees and blind the eyes and obliterate the dailiness of life."
Gosh.
It was just so crushing to read these portions of how grief came in these moments that were, previously just daily habits, but now each of them came with a hole in them. And speaking of the loss of her husband, she says, "I could not count the times during the average day when something would come up that I needed to tell him. This impulse did not end with his death. What ended was a possibility of response."
Yeah.
So many times listening to this book, I felt myself just pressing my own hand to my heart.
Yeah.
In a way that it took McConaughey repeating "enough" about 70 times before I got to that point.
That last part reminds me of this quote by Samuel Butler. "The dead are often just as living to us as the living are, only we cannot get them to believe it. They can come to us, but till we die, we cannot go to them. To be dead is to be unable to understand that one is alive."
Wow.
I had sort of that the other day. I had this coworker who died by suicide a few years ago, and I had a dream the other day of just talking to him and just being like, "What were you going through? Like, what happened?" And then I woke up and realized, like, oh no, I didn't actually get that closure.
Oh,
but my mind keeps trying to give it to me.
I just thought of a really dumb joke. I don't know if this is a good place for it. Just to close my comments here, when I say honesty in how she writes, to me it's that in addition to her ability to crystallize these sort of loss-induced epiphanies, it's also that she'll mention things about her husband that she didn't necessarily like. Like, she doesn't lionize him the way that I feel like McConaughey does with his abusive father. Like, instead, she's just upfront with stories. Like, this one time when she was on a helicopter that was flying her daughter to a hospital, and one of the pilots was taking pictures down below of what he thought was the Grand Canyon, and Joan Didion keeps insisting that it is not the Grand Canyon. And then she hears her husband's voice in her head saying, "Why do you always have to be right?" And she communicates in the book soon after that that she doesn't always have to be right, that she's lived a lifetime of the opposite, of being afraid of being wrong. Mm. And that is something that she never shared with her husband, which made it that much harder for her to hear that from him every time.
Oh, yeah.
And just the fact that she includes, like, not just these moments of "I can't get rid of his shoes," but then these other moments that trigger this response that she wasn't a big fan of either. To me, it just sort of, the whole book becomes this mosaic of just a real person.
Yeah.
Which makes these grieving moments that much more impactful emotionally than Matthew McConaughey, who almost writes himself as a caricature of himself.
I'm not sure it's a caricature. All right, lesson two. Much of our grief is shared. The thing I kept seeing in this book was how much of her description of grief I recognized in my own experiences with grief, even though, as Kellen said, mine have obviously been smaller than hers. And I just came away thinking it was beautiful, the elements of grief that are shared or that have universal qualities. She says on the day that she lost her husband, "Of course I knew John was dead. Of course, I'd already delivered the definitive news to his brother. The New York Times knew. Yet I was myself in no way prepared to accept this news as final. There was a level on which I believed that what had happened remained reversible. That was why I needed to be alone. After that first night, I would not be alone for weeks. There would never not be people in the house. But I needed that first night to be alone. I needed to be alone so that he could come back.
Oh, man.
Kellen, I don't know if you've ever had grief where your mind is always trying to reverse it. Like, I've had people die suddenly where my first reaction is, okay, if we learn all the details and it's a small thing, then we can still fix this.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think with death, in some ways, it feels like you're slightly insane, like your reality is fractured. I remember when my grandma died, I was 14 and I was waiting for my carpool and my mom came out of her room and told me, and I went and very calmly called my carpool and said I didn't need a ride. And then I went out into the backyard and leaned against the wall and just cried.
Oh, my word.
Then the next morning she says, when only half awake, I tried to think why I was alone in the bed. There was a leaden feeling. It was the same leaden feeling with which I woke on mornings after John and I had fought. Had we had a fight? Then I remembered. For several weeks, that would be the way I woke to the day. Kellen, I don't know if you experience grief this way, but for me, I wake up and it's the first thing I remember. It's like being punched, or it's like being shocked awake.
Mm-hmm. There's this whole section where she talks about what you think grief is going to be and then what it actually is.
Yeah.
And she says something like, we don't expect to be literally crazy. She puts it, cool customers who believe their husband is about to return and need his shoes.
Right. Yeah, there's that whole section where she's trying to give away his clothes a few weeks later, and she just can't give away his shoes because if he comes back, he's going to need his shoes.
Yeah.
She knows that that's what she's thinking, and it's a crazy thing to think. Mm. But knowing that does not weaken the power of the thought.
Yeah, she goes on later to talk about how she started seeing signs and symbols and things that were previously mundane. Like, there was a dictionary open to a page on his desk, and she started rifling through it and felt that she had committed a betrayal by not leaving it as it was.
Yeah.
Which she had. I mean, you don't touch my books. That makes a lot of sense to me. You know how half of all horror movies, the haunting started because someone messed with someone else's book?
The other day I was reading a book that was talking about mortality, and the author said something like, whether or not you believe it, there will be a final time that you like say I love you to someone, or that you see a sunrise, or there will be a final book you read. And the book one made me by far the saddest.
Those are interesting. I don't like thinking about those. I don't like, have you seen those calendars that are supposed to be motivating, but they're just sad to me? I don't know how many of those they sell, but have you seen those calendars where it's like, it's a grid of just thousands of squares, and it's supposed to represent every day of the rest of your life. And you just like, who's crossing that off? Like, it's an right. Advent calendar. Like, the end of this calendar is the opposite of Christmas.
Yeah, with my kids, instead of a Christmas chain, we make a death chain.
For me, those unwelcome, unsolicited sort of glimpse of reality into our how finite mortality is, they come up unexpectedly. Like, I haven't thought of that idea of like this last book or this last sunset, but I will look at the expiration date on my credit card and think, at some point, I'm going to look at this and wonder, will I be around?
Yeah, who will expire first?
Oh, we laugh because it's painful.
If humanity develops immortality technology, do you know how mad that last generation of deaths is going to be? Yeah. She talks about coming home from the hospital and his scarf is still sitting on the chair where he left it when he was fine just a couple hours ago, and how surreal that is. And sometimes, Kellen, the way I think about grief, it's sort of like someone chops down a tree and first the trunk hits and then all the hundreds of branches hit, where like the trunk is the big thing. The trunk is the death or the breakup or the failure or the loss. But then the branches are all the little reminders and all the little things you plan to do that will now not happen. Like you suddenly get the urge to pass something on to a loved one before you remember that they're gone. And it feels like after the trunk has fallen, the branches can still be falling for years.
Sure.
I want to end with this beautiful quote she has by Philippe Ahies. A single person is missing for you and the whole world is empty. Oh. All right, random facts. Kellen, do you have anything planned for your funeral?
I don't. That's something I haven't wanted to think about, I guess. Do you? Have you done that?
So one thing I'm planning, I have been creating a photo collection of photos that seem normal, but I'm hidden in them somewhere. And at my funeral, I'm going to have people play Find the Dave. But the fact that I'm doing this does sometimes frustrate Ummi. She has this video on our Italy trip of all the beautiful views of Lake Como. And then she pans and does a tight zoom, and you see my eyes poking out from behind some stairs.
So when Joan Didion was a child, her mother told her that one day she could win the Prix de Paris, which was a writing competition that Vogue magazine offered every year, the winner of which would get to choose if they wanted to live and work for Vogue in Paris or New York for a full year.
Wow.
And then in her senior year at Berkeley, she won it and moved to New York.
Wow. So unrelated to the book, this week I've been reading my journal from when I was 9, and I wanted to read you some of my favorite parts. Mm. So first, there was a time I did a report on the Aztecs. Their first city was on an island. They made huge buildings and temples that surprised the first Spaniards who saw them. Their empire stretched from the Pacific Ocean to the Gulf of Mexico. The way they sacrificed people was by stabbing the victim, then offering the beating heart to the gods.
Oh my word.
That's the end of that entry.
Oh, now I remember one of the things I have planned for my funeral.
Are you the heart or the god?
I forgot to mention, people don't know that it's going to be a funeral.
Next, this journal has my first record of a Dave story. I'm also working on a story I'm writing. It's about a boy who signs up to fight giants during medieval times. He stays at the camp a little while when he sees his brother, who's dead. The book's called Warriors of the Night. Then finally, I wrote a full movie review. On the movie yesterday, it was really funny. I thought the funniest person was Krunk. He had an angel on one shoulder and a devil on one shoulder telling him what to do. The devil and angel were funny too. The movie was about an emperor who's turned into a llama and is helped by a pheasant to get back home. One of my piano songs is Batman. I had a story in elementary school that starts with this character named Kyle Timmons, and it says, "It was just another ordinary day for a 19-year-old. A 19-year-old government agent, that is."
Oh, man. Oh, I love an opening line of a book that ends with, "that is."
I liked it so much as a line, I used it again for the ending. That was my full circle moment.
I love this that Didion wrote in a Vogue article about self-respect. She says, quote, "However long we postpone it, we eventually lie down alone in that notoriously uncomfortable bed, the one we make ourselves."
Oh.
There's a great Netflix documentary about Joan Didion that I watched. It's called The Center Will Not Hold. Have you seen it?
No. Wow. You really went deep for this episode, huh?
I mean, I enjoyed her writing so much. I was so curious about the rest of her life. And I watched it and I was like, it's crazy that I don't know more about a woman who was such an icon of a writer, especially during the 60s. She says once of a house party, she seems like an introverted type of person, but she was incredibly famous at the time. And she says in this documentary, Someone once brought Janis Joplin to a party at the house. She had just done a concert and wanted a brandy and Benedictine in a water tumbler. Music people never wanted ordinary drinks. The fact that she was not really in that whole scene, by the fact that she's calling rock stars music people.
Music people.
There's another neat part in the documentary where Harrison Ford appears for like 2 minutes, because apparently he worked as a carpenter renovating their house in Malibu. So it was before he was even an actor.
Wow.
But then he became friends with her family, and he said that they would invite him over to dinners. And he said, "I always felt like everyone there was smarter than I was, more cultured than I was." And I was like, yeah, I can't imagine eating dinner with these two.
Who was it that when Harrison Ford got famous, they were like, "Oh, that's my pot dealer."
It was probably Jabba. And then to me, the funniest part about the whole documentary is when Tom Brokaw asks Joan Didion in an interview, he says, "Were you surprised that Play It As It Lays was made into a movie?" And she says, "No, I wasn't surprised. I wish it had been made into a better movie."
All right, to recap, our favorite lessons from the year of magical thinking. 1, much of our grief is shared. 2, honesty induces greater empathy.
And 3, now go out there, have fun this week, and party like a music person.